Hello and welcome to Everyday Ethics, your weekly free ethical download from the BBC with me, William Crawley. This week, are gay people lepers and can they be cured? The lecture tour coming to a church hall near you. After the findings of a major new report, should the UK government change the law on assisted dying? Telling the truth about the troubles, are the police becoming the Boston bunglers? And would you take an OBE? Why gongs are an ethical dilemma. The latest ex-gay event to come to Belfast, offering gay people here the opportunity to be healed of their homosexuality. The conference is to be held later this month in a Presbyterian church in East Belfast, but members of Northern Ireland's gay community are outraged that the word lepers is being used in the event's advertising materials. Mike Davidson is director of the Core Issues Trust, who are organising the event. John O'Doherty's here from the Rainbow Project. Also here, Lindsay Conway, director of social services for the Presbyterian Church. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Let me come to you first, Mike, about the event itself. It uses the word lepers in its title. Why are you doing that?
It refers to a biblical metaphor or story, I suppose, in Mark chapter 1, when Jesus reached out to the lepers and touched a leper, and in so doing really broke the stereotype that religious folk of the day had that seemed to suggest that people with leprosy were untouchable. So we're using a kind of extended metaphor to say that the church really does need to wake up and make sure that it has a responsible and appropriate response to people.
Leprosy is a disease. Are you saying gay people are diseased?
No, we're saying that the church actually suffers from a disease that causes itself to look at homosexuality in a kind of hierarchical arrangement of sin, when in fact there is a great deal that is happening among heterosexual folk that actually has been let slip for decades.
There are some straight lepers too.
Well, I don't think we are concentrating essentially on calling anybody a leper other than those who need to be recognised for the fact that they too should be recipients of the grace of the Lord
John
Jesus.
John O'Doherty, there's your explanation.
Well, it's a case of being shocked but not surprised, William. The Core Issues have decided to run this conference. The use of the term lepers is completely unacceptable. If it's about a metaphoric approach, then it should be called the metaphoric lepers among us, not the lepers among us. We've got severe concerns about the speaker who's coming over, Jim Reynolds. He's also responsible for a book called Why We Don't Shoot Our Wounded, which is about supporting fallen church leaders who fall into all different types of difficulties or issues, such as sex scandals, being re-supported within our churches. What we're hearing from Mike is exactly what we've heard before: nice words surrounding real hatred. This is about conditioning gay people to believe that there is something wrong with them, that they are metaphoric lepers living among us, telling them that there is something wrong. Mike tells us that this process is only open to people who choose it, but do people choose it when they're being told or are led to believe that there is something wrong with who they are, when their families are being told that there's something wrong with who they are, and then they're being encouraged to access this type of support, this type of service, which is completely unethical?
Our focus is very much on the church, and therefore our invitations have gone out primarily to conservative churches who we hope will take the suggestion that far more work needs to be done to be inclusive of people who raise the issue of same-sex attraction. And therefore,
why would a gay person want to go to a church that calls them a leper?
I have to say, William, that I felt like a leper in the church. When I began to share with people what I was struggling with, particularly as a married man with children, I felt people coming back to me saying, well, you're really brave to share this with us, but please don't share it in the congregation.
They treated you like a leper.
I felt
because
like
you say
a leper.
You had same-sex attractions.
I had homosexual inclinations in my life. I had chosen not to identify as gay, but I certainly had lived the experience to some extent, and I had experienced all of that. But I was very conflicted with my Christian faith, and therefore, when I came to the church, when I began to believe my reading of the Bible, which seemed to teach me that homosexuality is not God's ideal,
Do you mean by that it's a sin?
Yes. For me, it definitely was a sinful way of life that I wanted to get away from.
The speaker that you've got coming to this conference, Jim Reynolds, he's an American, he's trained in biblical theology and the like. He has a book out, The Lepers Among Us, which is where you get the title from this. Had a look at that book, and he answers some questions in there about ex-gay therapy, about therapy that purports to help someone stop being gay and to become heterosexual. Mm-hmm. And he's asked the question in there, should a gay person seek that therapy? And his answer is yes, they should, and they should expect to be changed.
I think that
you agree
is
with
very
that?
Much in the context of those who desire to change.
It's not the context of the book. The question
away.
In the book is, should you expect to be changed? Yes, is what he says.
The broad context of the book very definitely is not in any way slamming gay people who are happy and content in their relationship.
Well,
but
if you believe homosexuality is a sin, the mere fact that someone's happy in it shouldn't in itself be a justifying factor, surely.
Well, I don't think we should focus on our experience if we're evangelicals. I think we should focus more on what we believe to be the received word of God. And I think that's what Jim Reynolds does.
Let me bring in Lindsay Conway. Lindsay,
to do.
This event is being hosted by a Presbyterian church in East Belfast. And you've got two Presbyterian ministers who have sent around letters of endorsement, the Reverend Derek McKelvey and the Reverend David Johnston. We asked them to appear on this programme. They declined to do so this morning. Do you think it's appropriate that Northern Ireland's largest Protestant denomination should in any way be connected to this kind of event?
First of all, I want to say that the use of language is just so important in all
Leprous.
Of this. Yes, I was just shocked when it was brought to my attention on Friday. I mean, this morning we have the Prime Minister being called to book with regards to his...
A joke about Tourette's syndrome.
Yeah.
And he's apologised
for that.
And
language always in the use of this has been so important. We as a central church have not been asked to endorse this.
Well, what do you think of this language of lepers?
It's just appalling. I mean, I think the issue for me is twofold. Not that it's just a metaphor, but that it's offensive to those who are leprosy sufferers.
Well, we know it was always intended to be a metaphor.
Yes,
no one is suggesting that gay people actually have leprosy.
No, but I mean...
But is the metaphor itself offensive?
I think so. I mean, if you read... Matthew's account of that miracle. The last part of the account also asks the healed leper to go and prove that he is healed. That's the other element of that story. And if you take that metaphor to its conclusion, then you're back to this issue of can a homosexual be healed? And those issues have been about for such a long time. And as a response to some of this, the General Assembly did issue pastoral guidelines some years ago to assist in that overall pastoral care. And really the plea at that time was to use the appropriate language.
Do you think this kind of language is consistent with the Presbyterian Church's pastoral guidelines?
No, not so.
But this event is taking place in a Presbyterian church.
Well... congregations are independent and autonomous.
So they could just break the guidelines when they choose to?
Well, I can't think for one minute that David or Derek have intended to cause offence in any of this.
Whether if someone was to allow a pro-choice meeting or event or conference within the Presbyterian Church, would that be accepted?
Again, John, it would have to be the individual congregation to make that
decision. I don't believe that that's the case.
Well, let's stick with this particular case.
Yeah.
What is your message to these Presbyterian ministers who are associated with us, with Mike Davidson's organisation, which is using the language of leper?
I think we have to be careful. They have to be careful. If any flyer is open to interpretation, then it's not hitting the appropriate spot. If it's got dual meaning, if it's got a multitude of meanings, then you've lost your impact immediately.
Well, you're losing your impact now because you were outraged a minute ago by the word itself.
Yeah.
Why not simply say to these people, this is outrageous. Don't do this.
Well, I think I said that I was shocked. I mean, outraged if that adds to it. I think it's a very, very careless use of language to get across a message that, Mike, I feel the motivation, the programme seems to be balanced as I looked at it. There's opportunity to discuss all of the issues within this debate. But why use such an extreme metaphor to bring home a message that I think the motivation is pastoral. I think the motivation is to respond and not to react. But this, to me, is...
Do you think it's homophobic language?
I can't say that, William. No, I mean, I don't think that intention has been there.
If you call a black person a leper, you'd be called a racist, wouldn't you?
You would be.
But if you can call a gay person leper, you're not homophobic.
Well, I don't accept that they're calling gay people lepers. I think it's the
Even
issue.
As a metaphor.
Well, it's a metaphor. It's open to interpretation. That's what
I'm saying.
Well,
you're saying there's something wrong with you.
Well, yes.
That's not homophobic.
I don't think it's meant to be homophobic.
I'm not saying if it's meant to be, is it?
It could be interpreted that way,
It could be seen to be homophobic.
Yes, it could be.
Do you
it
think
is
it's homophobic?
It is absolutely homophobic. The point being made is if you don't change who you are, then you will continue to be unclean, you will continue to be unacceptable to the church. Mike has said that the aim is to bring as many church leaders as possible to this conference so that they could hear the message of how about the lepers among us and how they can be changed. That is about sending out this message further that homosexuality or sexual orientation is something that can actually be changed. Someone's same-sex attraction can be changed through this type of therapy, conditioning people to believe that there is something wrong with who they are and trying to spread that message out as far as possible. It is a completely unethical practice for someone to come forward seeking support in the difficulties that they're experiencing through their sexual orientation and to tell them, well, that's because you don't really want to be gay and there's something wrong with being gay and we can change.
Mike Davis would be very patient listening to both of you giving it to him in each end of the neck. Go ahead, Mike.
A year ago, we had a conference called Setting Love in Order in which Mario Bergner took place. Following that, we had a conference with Alan Chambers, president of Exodus International. The title of his book is Leaving Homosexuality. The title of this conference is The Lepers Among Us because it's one of the primary books written by Jim Reynolds. I think it's important to cut to the chase and go to the essence of what these authors are saying. If I had used a title like Loving the Gay People into Our Churches, there may still have been objections. There certainly would have been objections once people Googled Jim Reynolds and saw that he wrote such a book.
Different kinds of objections, but this is a very significant objection. You've got one claim here that this is clearly homophobic, and you've got the Director of Social Services of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland saying it could well be homophobic.
Well, they are entitled to their opinion. I deny that it's homophobic. This is my journey. This is my journey with the church, as it is many other people's journey. There are issues within the evangelical church that has set homosexuality on some kind of pedestal that is very dangerous. Our invitation is to the church. Gay folk who are not concerned to move away from homosexuality have every right, every legal right, and may be very well balanced and happy in what they're doing. I've said that on many occasions. People who I meet in counselling rooms,
but you
are
don't
not
really believe
people.
That, Mike. You don't I really believe. You don't really believe. Let me just make the point first. You don't really believe that someone who is gay and in an active same-sex relationship and is happily so, you don't really believe that they don't have a problem. You believe it's a sin.
From my reading of Scripture, yes, I do believe homosexuality is a sin.
So you can't really say that we don't have a problem with
people.
I know, but you can't really say we don't have a problem with somebody who's happily gay. You do have a problem with that.
I think as a person who would hopefully want to contribute to the debate within society, yes, I would say from a Christian point of view, it's not a biblical lifestyle. But I do not believe that anybody...
That's not a therapeutic judgment, incidentally.
Well, you know, we're going between theology and all sorts of things.
Mike, if someone came into you for support, saying, I'm struggling with my same-sex attraction, but ultimately I want to be able to deal with my same-sex attraction, I want to form a loving relationship with someone of the same sex, form a family... Would you support that person? Or is your role in helping people turn away from their same-sex attraction? And if that is the case, it is conditioning people. It is conditional support, conditional counselling. And to be honest, we have seen this in the past where reparative therapy therapists or conversion therapists have been removed from professional organisations like the BACP for this type of conditional treatment. It is completely unethical.
It is completely unethical to say to a person who's struggling with homosexuality that they must change and that counselling or psychotherapy will and can always change them. So to answer your question, if somebody comes into a therapy context and says what was your question? Was it
if they want to form a relationship with
someone
of the same sex?
If they're happily gay.
But they want to be happily sex.
If they want to be happily gay, I would support them in finding the best therapeutic support that...
But you're not offering it.
How can I, William?
Because you believe
would I be
they
the
should.
Appropriate person
you believe
to
they
do it?
Should try to
counseling and therapy is always a contractual relationship between two individuals. It's got to work for both.
But it's not the approach can't be conditional. The ultimate.
Of course, it's conditional.
Absolutely
it's always
not.
Conditional when people come in for therapy. Both therapist and client have to find whether or not they can work together. And if I can't work with somebody, I would refer them.
If people
on.
Don't meet the conditions you require for this type of therapy, then they are removed. You've just said that. They get sent somewhere else. If they don't meet the
removed,
conditions...
sent. These are very emotive
Lindsay's trying to get in.
You have to remove the two elements of counselling and therapy. Counselling will bring people along a journey to identify possible issues, possible problems. Therapy treatment then is the next stage. So from that point of view, you have to distill those two things out.
But would you trust, any organisation that's using leper language of gay people, even metaphorically, with therapy for gay people, with treatment for gay people, with counselling for gay people?
I think I can't. What I've read about core issues and so forth, this is not characteristic of it. This is an extreme, William, which I think...
It's an extreme
just,
they've engaged in.
Yes, and I think that...
So that's
that,
back to the question.
Yes,
would
going
you
to
trust
have,
them on the basis of that?
On the surface, no, but...
You wouldn't trust them to offer counselling?
Well, I can see why those struggling with a sexual identity would now maybe sort of be apprehensive and look at things differently.
Because you think this could be homophobic... And you now have doubts about whether this organisation should be trusted with counselling gay people.
Well, I think those with same-sex relationships are going to hesitate now because of the extreme language. I think
you're hesitating too.
I'm hesitating because I think there's good work.
They've
that
crossed
has
the
been
line,
done.
Though. You think
they've crossed a line which to make impact has taken away from what is I think a significant conference. I think if back to what I was saying, if something can be open to interpretation in its extremes, and this is, then it's regrettable. So, mate, from that point of view, to distill those two things out, then some new ground will have to be gained.
And when gay people come to the Presbyterian Church through your office, perhaps, and ask about core issues about this organisation, what will your advice be to them about whether they are a safe organisation to work with?
Well, I think there would be a number of organisations that you would at least bring to people's attention.
Oh, you still recommend them?
I think until until we
after what
see,
you've just said, you'd be prepared to recommend them.
No, there's still an option, William. You
this
can't
might be homophobic.
Out.
You're not sure they should be trusted, but they're an option for sensitive counselling.
Well, I will wait and see what the conference holds, and I will attempt to attend the conference. I'm not sure what the date is, the 20th of September.
20th and the 21st of January at Orangefield Presbyterian.
I don't know how, Lindsay, you're the Director of Social Services for the largest Protestant church in Northern Ireland. Tell me how you can hold those positions together in one head. This may be homophobic. I'm not sure we can trust them, but there's still an option for sensitive counselling.
No, you're putting words in my mouth.
No, I'm trying to tease your position out of it.
Right, OK. At the moment, if someone came tomorrow No, I would not recommend, I would have to say.
Why? Thank him.
Because I do have concerns. And I would attend the conference and see what that means. And I think it's regrettable that the title of the conference is taken away from the elements of the conference.
And will you be saying to the Presbyterian ministers who are now on the board of advisors of this organisation that you have doubts about whether they should be involved in it?
Well, I haven't discussed any of this with David or Derek, and I will have to do that, yes.
Mike?
I think we need to not lose sight of the fact that really any initiative that offers an alternative to what the gay liberation movement is offering.
It's a very old term, that.
Well, I'm an old-fashioned person. I'm not scared to admit that. But any alternative is something that is going to be objected to. However we package it, whoever we bring forward, there are objections on some level.
Hold on. This is about appropriate care, Mike. Let's be clear. The BACP, the IACP, both say that this type of therapy is possibly dangerous to people. Let's be clear. Is Core Issues a member of any professional organisation such as the BACP and the IACP?
I think what we need to bear in mind is in the UK...
Answer the question. We're talking about
yes,
a professional
service. Yes, I am affiliated to a professional body personally through my therapeutic training.
Which body's that?
I'm the British Psychodrama Association, the BPA.
And Core Issues is now a registered charity?
Core is a registered charity. It is a member of the Evangelical Alliance. It will be a member of the Institute the International Institute for Therapeutic Choice. If we're accepted in that context. Why should we not be offering therapeutic options for people who seek support in their struggle with homosexuality? The APA,
Let's be clear about what you say you're offering. You're offering therapeutic options based on a moral and theological position, which is that homosexuality is a sin.
Well, here we straddle the great divide between philosophy and theology.
You
do want me to make a theological statement?
If I go to a secular psychiatrist, I don't expect the secular psychiatrist to have a therapeutic position shaped by a moral view. That would be considered unprofessional.
Well, it's not shaped. The secular science is not clear on this issue. The APA, remember,
the American
Psychological Association has said there is no evidence one way or the other. That does not mean, therefore, that they have said that reparative therapy or same-sex efforts to change same-sex orientation should therefore be banned. That has only been done by some psychotherapeutic organisations in the UK, not the APA.
John, let me put this point to John O'Doherty. If someone has same-sex attractions, to use Mike's language, if they're gay, to use other language, but they're not happily so, they're struggling with this, for whatever reason, maybe their family, their society, their church, themselves, they don't want to be this way. And there is a therapeutic alternative, a route, which may lead them to the possibility that they could be heterosexual, have a marriage, have children, and be happily heterosexual. Why isn't that a reasonable option for someone?
Well, for many people who are unhappy with their sexual orientation, we have to look at why they're unhappy with their sexual orientation. And usually that is the conditioning of either family members or churches or whoever who tell them that there is something wrong with who they are. This idea that there's something wrong isn't something that they've created themselves. It's something that has been dictated to them from another source. It's something that they have taken from somewhere else. The Rainbow Project provide a professional co-cultural counselling service. We have helped many, many people who have struggled with same-sex attraction come to terms with their sexual orientation. That doesn't mean people have to go out and form relationships right away. It doesn't mean they have to form relationships at any point in their life. What this is about is supporting people in being happy with who they are. What Mike is talking about doing is getting people to change what their sexual orientation
is.
I have sat in on the previous conference, Mike, where your speaker had said that people are gay because they have an overbearing mother and an absent father. That idea of conditioning, that there's some reason for you being the way you are.
In some cases, yes.
No, it's clearly, from scientific fact, it is clearly stated that sexual orientation is something that can't be created through environmental factors.
All right, well, I'm going to talk to a scientist about some of this in a second. My thanks to John, Mike and Lindsay. Some of your text messages on 81771. Deja vu, another discussion promoting homosexuality in the churches. That's how some people hear that. Good morning, William. I'm not long awake and already my blood is boiling. I am gay and very proud. Gay is natural. That's someone in Belfast. Man created by God cannot be changed. This is an incitement to hatred, says Thomas. If this use of the word leper is not homophobic, what is? Teresa says, come on, spit it out. Don't dither or water it down to suit the homosexuals. The homosexual act is wrong and unnatural. We don't see our domestic animals doing this. Really? We can't accept this just because it's happening. We hate the sin, but not the sinner, says Teresa. Let's talk to Philip McGarry. Dr. Philip McGarry is chair of the Royal College of Psychiatrists in Northern Ireland. He's here in the studio with us, and he's been sitting listening to this conversation. What's your sense of what you've just been hearing, Philip?
Well, this is really very clear. First of all, homosexuality is not a mental illness. That's absolutely clear.
So it doesn't need therapy?
No, homosexuality does not need therapy. It is not a mental illness. It was a case in the past that gays were terribly persecuted in the Middle Ages. They were burnt at the stake. They were tortured in the most excruciating, appalling ways. And society couldn't cope with homosexuality. In a sense, perhaps in the 19th century, it moved on a bit to saying, well, they aren't evil people. Perhaps they're ill in some way. And to a degree, science, medicine as a whole partly colluded with that for a certain period, but it's very clear the resolved position within the scientific community is that homosexuality is not a mental illness, and there is no reason why people don't feel entirely comfortable with being gay. There's no difference between gay people and heterosexual people. It's not a lifestyle choice. It is really where you are. It is what you are.
Can it be changed?
There's no evidence whatsoever that any therapeutic process can change people from being gay to being straight, or indeed can change people from being straight to being gay. There are many, many efforts over the years to prove that you can, and absolutely no evidence whatsoever.
So this kind of conversion
of all the scientific literature by the various bodies, both the psychiatric organisations, the psychological associations, and it's absolutely clear-cut. There's no evidence whatsoever that you can change someone from being gay to being straight.
So do you regard this kind of conversion therapy as pseudoscience, bogus?
Well, there's no evidence whatsoever that anybody can be converted from being gay to being straight, or indeed from being straight to being gay. No evidence whatsoever of any credibility.
That means it's bogus, this kind of conversion, which is predicated on something that has no evidence for it.
Well, it's very clear that the whole premise, and I looked at the core website, is based upon the fact that homosexuality is a sin, and that clearly is where the whole process comes from. There's a presumption, and here, Mike, it's very clear, he has from his point of view, a very genuine perception, his perspective, it is a sin. And then from that, because clearly he wants to help people, he sees it moving from what he calls sin. But it is trying to get the science to fit in with the actual religious conviction, really. Obviously, from the scientific, medical point of view, we don't agree with the concept of sin in the first place. You come along as a person to a doctor, a psychologist, a nurse, who must treat you with respect as to where you are.
Mike's intervening. Let me just give him a quick intervention. Go ahead.
Well, Professor Andrew Sims, I think it was, past president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, only within the last month, I think, has given a preface to a book by Professor Glenn Harrison, in which he sees the idea of talking therapies as being necessary and important for supporting people who struggle with homosexuality.
We all, as psychiatrists, see many people who come along who have difficulties where they are in terms of sexuality, and you deal with that as it is. The evidence that you can convert someone is absolutely nil. There's no evidence whatsoever you can convert someone. You, of course, can help people to come to terms with all the issues around being gay, which, as John has said quite often, are tied in with prejudice
and
societal
attitudes.
We have
a suicide impact in this society about people who struggle with their sexuality. What do you think is the impact of language like leper?
I think it's absolutely appalling, and indeed, as a psychiatrist, I would see many young men who come along with depression, anxiety, suicidal thinking, and not infrequently there is an association with what goes on, not least in a school environment. And I'm appalled. I mean, I remember in the early 90s, started working in the Royal Victoria Hospital, and I covered the clinic, the clinic in the Royal, looking after patients with HIV, and at that time it was more or less a death sentence. And I was quite disgusted by how often at school it was routine for people to be bullied, and the establishment really did very, very little for those people. And I remember the great dignity of people who had an illness which then was lethal, and yet an amazing amount of dignity and compassion they were showing. And shocking thing, a man who was in his mid-30s, a very prominent position within, so to say, part of the Catholic establishment, he wasn't a clergyman or anything, who told me, I can tell my mother I'm dying, I'm 35, I can't tell her I'm gay. And that's a shocking indictment of our society and the prejudice towards gay people.
Dr. Philip McGarry, Chair of the Royal College of Psychiatrists in Northern Ireland. My thanks also to, excuse me, John O'Doherty from the Rainbow Project, Mike Davidson from Core Issues Trust, and Lindsay Conway. Next big ethics discussion this morning is the British government moving towards changing the law on assisted suicide. This week, the Commission on Assisted Dying, chaired by the former Lord Chancellor, Lord Falconer, has recommended that consideration should be given to allowing some terminally ill people to end their lives at home with the help of a doctor. Raymond Tallis is Chair of Healthcare Professionals for Assisted Dying. He's an Emeritus Professor of Geriatric Medicine as well. Brendan McCarthy is National Medical Ethics Officer for the Church of England. Good morning to you both. Welcome to Sunday Sequence.
Good morning, William.
Good morning. Raymond, could you summarise first of all what this commission is proposing and what it is not proposing?
Would you like me to start on that?
Please do, yes.
Yes, I mean, they propose that people who are terminally ill, who are mentally competent, who are adults, and who have unbearable symptoms, should be able to have the assistance to die if that is their settled wish, and if their prognosis is less than a year.
Terminally ill, medically competent, prognosis of less than a year, and it's their settled consent issue here.
Just to clarify, mentally competent. That
mentally competent as well.
They can make an informed decision.
Brendan McCarthy, those are safeguards, are they not?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Lord Falconer's report runs to 400 pages, and what he says consistently throughout it is that there ought to be safeguards put in place to ensure that those criteria are met. But in the 400 pages, he fails actually to say what the effective safeguards would be. Now, the position of the Church of England is that vulnerable individuals are likely to be at greater risk of abuse under the Falconer Commissioner's proposals than under the current law. Now, of course, there are lots of principled arguments as well, but dealing with Falconer on his own basis, if you like, the major concern at the moment with the Falconer proposals is that they're not safeguarded against abuse. And we already know that in England every year, over a third of a million elderly people suffer abuse. And in half of those cases, the abuse is at the hands of their nearest and dearest. And in a quarter of all cases, the reason for the abuse is financial gain. Now, this is a huge area for discussion and debate, and it's not good enough for Falconer and his commission to say safeguards ought to be put into place and they ought to be effective. He needs to say precisely what those safeguards would be and how they would be so effective that vulnerable individuals won't be placed at greater risk than they are currently under the present law.
Raymond Tallis.
Well, indeed. I think it's a bit disingenuous to suggest that Lord Falconer doesn't discuss safeguards in his 400 pages. He discussed them at great detail, and I'll come to those in a second. But I want to pick up on this canard that this kind of law would particularly threaten vulnerable people, elderly people or people who are not able, who are not mentally competent and so on. The law is so framed as actually to protect specifically vulnerable groups, to give them greater protection than they have at present, and I'd be happy to spell that out. But I guess it's important when one's making what are essentially empirical assertions about what might happen to look at what actually happens in legislations elsewhere where such a law is in place. And Lord Falconer and his team actually spent a lot of time looking at, for example, Oregon and Washington and the Netherlands and so on, precisely to address the anxieties that many people have felt, and Brendan's just expressed, that vulnerable people might actually be forced, as it were, to seek assisted dying against their will. And in none of those legislations, none of those jurisdictions, has this proved to be the case.
So that's the slippery slope argument being countered, Brendan. Do you believe that people, vulnerable people in those jurisdictions, are actually a greater threat?
Well, I think they are. And of course, the difficulty with using statistics is that they're only as good as the research case that's been carried out. Now the Commission commissioned its own research. It's a 110-page document. And if you read your way through that, what it says clearly that in all jurisdictions where safeguards have been put in place, those safeguards have failed in one or more cases. For example, could I say that the monitoring rate of assisted suicide and euthanasia, for example, in the Netherlands is 80%. In Belgium, it's 50%. So in the Netherlands, there are 20% of unreported cases. In Belgium, there are 50% of unreported cases. And we're not at all aware of whether or not all the supposed safeguards have actually been carried out in those jurisdictions.
Raymond.
Well, I think one's got to look at historical trends. The situation in both Netherlands and Belgium has become safer for people as a result of legislation. But the most important and interesting historical trends come from Oregon, where their laws are rather similar to the ones that were envisaged in Lord Joffe's bill, and where I think would be envisaged by the Faulkner Commission. And what they have found is there has been absolutely no trend towards threatening vulnerable people, but in fact the numbers of people who actually have assisted dying have remained steady.
Well, look, since this is an empirical point rather than a moral principle you're debating at this point, isn't it the case, Raymond, that there have been some studies suggesting in, for example, the Netherlands, that you had people who went through euthanasia, in fact, not just assisted suicide, who gave no consent as part of that entire process?
Well, I can offer you two answers to that. One is, of course, as you know, the Lord Faulkner and indeed Lord Joffe's bill was not about assisted suicide. And perhaps for the listeners, it's important to separate
assisted dying.
Assisted dying is for somebody who is terminally ill, who is in the process of dying. Assisted suicide is for someone who doesn't have a terminal illness, who may have a chronic disability or whatever. Now, Lord Joffe and indeed Lord Faulkner have advocated that we should have assisted dying. Now, within the UK at the moment, a study carried out by Clive Seal, it found out that, on average, per year, there are approximately 1,000 people who actually had assisted dying of some sort outside the law, and another 1,000 or so who had assisted dying outside the law without giving explicit consent. If we have a law, it won't be skis taking us down the slippery slope. It will be crampons stopping us falling down what is already, in my opinion, a slippery slope because of the absence of the law. The law itself is a safeguard. And in fact, in addition to that, Lord Faulkner has made extremely clear the kinds of safeguards that would be necessary.
OK, Brendan, let's just envisage a situation in which we could put the safeguards in place to everyone's satisfaction. I know that's a debate in itself, but let's just imagine that situation. And the law is good and the law is in place. What's your moral objection to it?
Well, there are a number of objections, but one very important one is that we are, in fact, talking about assisted suicide. Now, the Commission was called the Commission on Assisted Dying, but that was Faulkner's own choice, and there was also his own definition to make the distinction between assisted dying and assisted suicide. And what he has said is that there's a strong argument for changing the law on assisted suicide. Now, the principle there is this is not about the freedoms and limitations on my choice to die. It's about the freedom and limitations on my ability to actively to participate in ending someone else's life. And that, if you like, is the legal and one of the main moral issues at stake.
Well, you can
here.
Resolve the legal issue if you change the law.
No, but the principle behind the law is, ought I to be allowed actively to participate in ending someone else's life? And since we struck off capital punishment from the statute books in the United Kingdom, no one is allowed or is given the freedom actively to participate in ending someone else's life. This is not about my right to die or my freedom to die. It's about my freedom to act in ending someone else's life. And that's one of the key moral principles that have to be
debated. Let me take a final word from Raymond Tallis on that.
Well, first of all, the analogy with capital punishment is inappropriate. When people voted for capital punishment, they weren't voting for themselves to be executed. They were voting for other people to be executed.
That's the precise point I'm making.
When I vote for assisted dying, I vote for the ability or the right I have to terminate or to receive assistance to terminate my life when, as a result of unbearable symptoms and inevitable prognosis of death, I basically feel that I no longer want to live. And that, to me, is totally appropriate. And it's appropriate also that those who, out of compassion, help me in my clear and settled wish should not have hanging over them the possibility of a charge of manslaughter and a 14-year jail sentence.
Raymond, Brendan, I'm grateful to you both. That's Professor Raymond Tallis and Dr. Brendan McCarthy with their rather contrasting views on the assisted dying debate, which has been all over the news this week. 81771 for your text messages. You're still texting us on some of those debates about homosexuality and ex-gay counselling and the big event that's coming to Belfast. Paul from Newtownard says, the scientist Philip McGarry said he doesn't agree with the concept of sin. Well, actually, I think what he said was he doesn't agree that homosexuality should be discussed in terms of sin language. I think that's what he's saying. I don't think he says there's no such thing as sin of any kind. Anyway, Paul continues, 50% of solving a problem is recognising it in the first place. So if we don't accept that there is a moral wrong of any kind in the world, there's not much hope of a solution or of moving away from the moral depravity that we see all around us. David has a query. Was Mitt Romney named Mitt at birth, or is it a nickname or short for something else? Is it short for Mitchell? My esteemed producer asks in my ear. I have no idea. Somebody get on to Wikipedia and tell me the answer to that. Another one here on 81771. As a Christian man who has struggled with same-sex attraction, I'm so thankful for options like CORE, which has provided me with nothing but support and compassion. My desire is to submit all my life to the Word of God, which is unambiguous in its pronouncement that homosexuality is sinful. Why shouldn't I be allowed the choice to acknowledge that over my life? And of course, you absolutely do have the choice to make whatever decisions you wish in respect of your sexuality in your own life. 81771 for your text messages. Also on assisted suicide. And this one, another big topic of the week. Does the pursuit of justice override all other concerns, including politics? Or is there a time when crimes have to be consigned to the past to allow reconciliation to flourish and a truth process to take hold? In the past few days, police here moved closer to their goal of obtaining tapes and transcripts of interviews given by former paramilitaries to Boston College. The interviewees had taken part after obtaining a guarantee that information would not be released until after their deaths. But the police position is that some of the information may help solve crimes and lead to prosecutions. With us is Baroness Nuala O'Loan, the security writer Brian Rowan, the loyalist William Smith, who agreed to be interviewed for the Boston College archives but now wants those tapes and notes to be returned, and former Sinn Féin publicity director Danny Morrison. Good morning to you all.
Good morning, William.
Danny Morrison, let me come to you first. Are you surprised that there should actually be a move to get this information by the state?
No, I'm not surprised. I think once the project was commercialised in the publication of a book, Voices from the Grave, and the fact also that one of the alleged participants, Dolores Price, did an interview in which it was claimed that what she was saying in the interview was similar to what was contained in the tapes in Boston College, I think that was put up to the authorities and the PSNI. And of course, if you were a son or daughter of Jane McConville, of course you were going to go to the authorities and say, what are you going to do about this? Here are people claiming to have killed my mother.
And it's a live investigation.
Pardon?
It's a live investigation still.
Yes, it's a continuing investigation. Now, I have other issues about how we deal with the past and the type of investigations that go on and what happens to people who, you know, in terms of, I think there's a disparity in treatment between former members of the state forces and former members of organisations such as the IRA.
I'll come to William Plumsmith. Good morning to you as well. Welcome to the programme. I know you're seeking to have the notes of your interviews returned to you. Was it made clear to you, because I think everyone who took part signed a contract, was it made clear to you at the outset of this process that the guarantee they offered could only go to the extent of American law? In other words, if American law and a treaty with the United Kingdom meant that material could be seized, could be handed over, that was a real possibility from the outset?
No, that was not on the radar even at that time, you know. We had just come out of a conflict and we'd just come out of a peace agreement and everybody was feeling good, so that wasn't even on the radar. So,
isn't that language in the contract that you signed?
Yes, it's basically... Well,
the contract that you signed says that, that the protection would be limited by American law.
I don't think I specifically mentioned American law. I'm not too sure. But the thing is that there was no historic inquiries team at that time. And it didn't come to 2005. And so there was nothing like that on the radar. But obviously, I was under the belief, as everybody else was, that they would be kept for 30 years in storage in Boston College and wouldn't be released.
Danny Morrison just handed me in the studio here a bit of paper with a quotation on it, which I'll read out to you, which says, prior to the commencement of the project, Robert K. O'Neill, the Burns librarian, that's at Boston College, cautioned Ed Maloney, that's the director of the project, that although he had not spoken yet with Boston College's counsel, the library could not guarantee the confidentiality of the interviews in the face of a court order. And that information, incidentally, is on the Boston University Burns, the Boston College Burns Library website. You can read the full documentation on their website. So, William, what I'm saying is at the outset, it appears that there was always a doubt about whether confidentiality could be fully and completely guaranteed.
I think you're narrowing the things down to just the Boston College. This was a project that was a wide-ranging project. I mean, we do these projects all the time, ex-prisoners and ex-combatants. I do hundreds in a year.
It's an oral history project. They have an all around the world. Yes, of course they do.
You know, students from all around the world come in and...
But the issue is if somebody admits to their involvement in a murder, even in an oral history project... Boston College has no exemption from the law here, you know.
Well, okay. If anybody steps outside the project, that's our problem. I didn't step outside the project.
I'll bring a lawyer in, Baroness Nuala O'Loan.
Well, I guess my feeling is that we're starting from the wrong starting blocks.
I often do that.
Because the starting block is what are the obligations of the police in investigation and what are the rights of families and what was the right of this, particularly Jean McConville, who was abducted and murdered by the IRA. So that's my starting point. My second point would be that those who are involved in both journalism and academic research know perfectly well that they cannot give ultimate and final promises of confidentiality.
The most you can probably say is, I'm prepared to go to prison not to give up my source, but you would have to go to prison.
But that's it. And the material which you have, subject to an application to the court. I mean, people can't just walk into your house. As a journalist, they'd have to make an application to the court under our law. But the material is recoverable for the purposes of investigation and should be so recoverable if we are to have anything which approximates to the rule of law.
This isn't just about law, though, or justice. It is about those things, too. There's some politics involved in this, too.
Well, you may call it politics, but what I think we actually see is a process in which we're involved in a post-conflict situation. A number of changes have been made to the law, which allow for certain situations, such as decommissioning and the recovery of the bodies of the disappeared. That there will be no admissibility of any evidence collected in those two things and no use of material or no further investigation for prosecution of the material which is gathered. So we have had adjustments made to the law. But the law remains, and if we are to build a firm basis, then I think that we have to respect the rule of law. And you know, if we've had this week the murder of Stephen Lawrence and the investigation of the murder of Stephen Lawrence took 18 years. Nobody in England ever suggested that because it was 18 years ago. Yeah. And even if you look at things like the Colin Howell...
Policing is always about the past.
Policing is always about the past, and in any police force in the world, there is never a limit. Well, that's not quite true, but certainly in common law jurisdictions, there is no limit upon when you can go back. if somebody has committed a crime, is suspected of a crime, there must be an investigation and the matter must be put to a court if there's sufficient evidence to go
and
to a court.
And when you have this kind of
the
treaty...
The other person has appeared.
Oh, I think we've maybe lost Plum Smith for a second. Let's see if we can get him back. If you have this treaty between Britain and the United States, which would enable British investigators to have a look at this information, yeah. And they've got 13 documents now in the district attorney's office somewhere in the United States, and that may make it to British authorities. We don't know. That's a matter for the courts. There are nevertheless limitations on those treaties. The United States doesn't have to hand over that information if certain provisos in the treaty are met. And Ed Maloney and Anthony McIntyre are making arguments, as is Boston College, that this information should not be handed over. It's a threat to the whole concept of an oral history project, for a start. But also some of the arguments that have been made, for example, by Anthony McIntyre, is that this would be a threat to his life.
Which is nonsense.
You don't believe it would be a threat
to his life? No, he spent the last 15 years ridiculing Gerry Adams, running down the IRA as having sold out. So how can he make that claim?
In his affidavit, which I read last night, he uses the word tout and said he'd be branded as a tout and he will probably be executed.
But sure, we have known... I didn't see these concerns raised when Ed Maloney published his book, Voices from the Grave, which included the alleged testimony of Brenton Hughes, in which other people were named and some people weren't named, in which I was named, for example. But Ed Maloney never came to me and asked me, give me the opportunity to rebut what was being said, nor to anybody else who's involved in the peace process and supports the Good Friday Agreement and who was formerly involved in the IRA.
Brian Rowan's here as well. We better bring Brian in too. And the other suggestion here, the other proviso that could be met in the terms of this treaty, which would stop the information crossing the Atlantic, is that this could be a threat to the peace process. If this information came out, would it be a threat to the peace process?
I don't think so. I think the problem is that we don't have a safe storytelling process, that there is no such thing as guaranteed confidentiality. And the big question, I think, is about how we want to deal with the past. Do we want to deal with it in continuing investigations, or do we want to have a process that is about truth, as it is called, or information, as others call it, and reconciliation? I don't see this as being something or a problem that has been created by the police, because while you still have an investigative process, and while the police still believe there are evidential opportunities or evidential work,
they're just doing their job.
And information, they are doing their job. I think the bigger question is there is not the political will to deal with the past because of its ugly truths. And I'm not just talking about the past in terms of loyalists and Republicans. I think there are others who want to hide in the dark corners of the past, who fear the type of ugly truth that will emerge.
There is a perceived amnesty, you know. There are people who believe that if you committed a crime before a certain date, you're not going to face prosecution about it.
Well, we've got the historical inquiries team there. It is going to continue its work, I'm told, until the end of 2013. And the most senior police officers here believe that there will not be serious consideration given to some alternative process until after that team completes its work in 2013.
I think it's important, if I may say so, William, to say that there is no amnesty.
Well, and I that said the perceived.
The legislation actually provides that there will be prosecutions. So that is where our society is at the moment. We have decided that there will be circumstances where evidence will not be admissible, so there can't be prosecutions. But where there is evidence which is admissible, then there will be prosecutions, there will be convictions, but there is a limit on sentence of up to 2 years.
And if you look at some of the documentation that's on this website from Boston College, you get the impression that some of the participants in this project believed that there would be an amnesty, that things have changed, that we're not going to be rooting down into all of that stuff again. So I can speak freely with a sort of guarantee.
Yes, but they were misinformed, and badly misinformed. I disagree with Nuala there in terms of the fact of the matter is that the difficulty we have is that the law is selectively applied. You have a position there where Gerry McGeoch has been returned to jail for an alleged offence in 1981. You won't see soldiers or RUC men going to prison. And that's why when Barney talks about the dark side of the war, this is the side that's covered up.
Is so Sinn Féin supporting him?
Is Sinn Féin supporting who?
You just mentioned he's...
Jeremy McGeoch should not be in jail, nor for that matter, in my opinion, should marry
the party's been quite silent on him.
Well, I don't speak for Sinn Féin.
I know.
But I mean,
but
I'm
the
Sinn Féin
has
supporter.
Been rather silent on him.
I don't know if that is the case, but certainly he should not be in jail, nor, in my opinion, should Marion Price have been returned to jail.
I think it depends on the circumstances. In the current situation, we do have a situation in which the law provides for him to be in jail. If it didn't, he'd be out of jail. I think the situation that we have is, as a society, as Brian has said, we need to make a decision about what we want to do about the past. But, I mean, I spent, and Danny's talking there about the, what he calls the state or its involvement, I spent yesterday with the what I call the ballast families, the families of those who were murdered, or who, those indeed who were the subject of attempted murders by UVF people. And I asked them, because I was coming on this programme, I asked them, well, what do you think? You know, should we have an amnesty? Should we have truth-telling? What should we have? And they said, what we need for this state, we need justice. And justice is the application of the rule of law. And it may not necessarily need to prosecutions, but it does allow the process of investigation to take place to verify facts such as are verifiable. I think it's profoundly important. As we're in an embryonic state, we have secured and garnered a lot of support for policing now across the community. I mean, when I became police ombudsman in 2000, there was, I mean, the Republican community were actively opposed to the police, and the loyalist community were at significant odds with the police. So we've come to another place now.
Yeah.
And I think in that context, it's profoundly important that we preserve that. And we will only preserve that if people believe that there is law and justice being law, particularly law, the rule of law being applied. If that's not the case, that support, I think, will begin to wane.
Plumsmith's back with us. We're widening this, William. We just want to get a sense of how you think we can talk about the past, and we all have a past. We've all been part of this. We all have some moral implications about our involvement or our lack of involvement in some aspects of Northern Irish life. It's important for the healing of the society that we're able to tell our stories. It's very important. What do you think of the lessons of this most recent episode, William, for that journey of telling our stories? Have we lost him? Put the question to Barney.
Well, I hear what Nuala's saying about talking to the ballast families. I think if you talk to another set of people, they may tell you that they want something different. Ballast was a hugely important report, but I think it is the tip of the iceberg in terms of the dirty war here in Northern Ireland. You know, Mark Haddock, an agent in the pay of the Special Branch, up to his neck in murder, and we're meant to believe that no one knew what was going on. So I remember David Irvine, and David Irvine, 5 years dead today, talking about, okay, let's talk about the agents, but let's also talk about the handlers. Let's talk about who was managing the handlers. Let's talk about the process and the policy behind all of that.
And that's what my ballast report is about, with respect to
that. No, I understand, but I go back to maybe what Danny was saying. I'm wondering how far investigation will get into that world. So, yes.
And there seem to be as many handlers as combatants.
Well, I can understand people wanting justice and people wanting investigation. But the question is, do we want to deal with the past or do we want to dwell in the past? Do we want a political process that will deliver as much information out of the past that gives us a much better understanding, not only of what happened, but why it shouldn't happen again? And I think investigation and continuing investigations are the massive barrier that stand in the way of people from all sides in this process coming forward, telling their stories and giving their information.
Nuala Long used an interesting phrase there, which was investigation language, but perhaps without the prosecution at the end of it. I mean, how would that work?
You asked me how
it
would be the situation in which you would conduct an investigation using full police powers, but at the end of that investigation, as in many cases, you would come to the conclusion that there is not sufficient evidence to charge an individual with the particular crime that you've been investigating. And then you give to the families such information as you have about it. I don't think the two are exclusive. The thing I would say about peace processes, and I've looked because I've worked sort of across the world on these issues, truth commissions, rather. The thing about truth commissions is that they're reliant on people coming forward to tell what they know. And the amnesties that attach very often to truth commissions are amnesties for individual crimes. They're not amnesties for individuals. And they're amnesties insofar as the individual has told the whole truth about the crime. And that does not normally happen. And if you go to South Africa is held up as the model Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I've spent time in South Africa. The people will tell you that the truth was not, the whole truth was not told. So we have to accept that any process in which we engage, whether it be historical truth-telling or anything, will be limited because there will be those who will not engage. The fact, for example, that the IRA and the UVF or someone were to say, well, we're going to engage, does not mean individual members will tell their story.
And you meet people now in South Africa who feel very aggrieved at what happened to them during that process.
That's
and they feel spiritualised and put upon, some of them, by Desmond Tutu's approach to it. Brian?
I think absolute truth is the impossible dream. I don't think we're going to achieve that. I actually talk
truth you can live with.
I talk about an explanation process where people come forward and explain their involvement, why they were involved. And Danny was involved in an event in West Belfast 2 years ago. I was chairing a panel. Martin McGuinness was on it. Plum Smith was on it. Jackie McDonald was in the audience, the UDA leader. And in that audience on that day, he spoke about the run-up to the 1994 ceasefires. The IRA had just declared its ceasefire. The loyalists were about, are considering whether or not to declare a ceasefire. And he said, in this room in which Martin McGuinness was sitting, Gerry Adams was sitting, Danny Morrison and many other Republicans, Peter Sheridan, the police officer, someone from the NIO sitting in that room, he said that in 1994, he didn't want a loyalist ceasefire until the loyalists had killed more Catholics. The IRA had killed Ray Smallwoods, they'd killed a number of other loyalists, and he wanted those killings avenged. Now, he said he didn't get his way at the time, and he's glad now in 2010 when he was speaking that he didn't get his way. But in 1994, that was his thinking, that more Catholics should be killed before a loyalist ceasefire was announced. Now, if you said to him, there's a room in which a number of judges and barristers are sitting, would he have made those comments? Would he have told that truth? He probably wouldn't have even gone into the room, William. And that's the point that I'm making, that how do we achieve the best information possible? And my position is you do not achieve it at this stage in this process through investigation.
And it looks like you don't achieve it through an oral history project either.
No.
Well, there are oral history projects. I mean, Duhas in West Belfast and Healing Through Remembering. And they've got ground rules which unfortunately weren't applied to those interviewees who took part in the Boston College project. And it is that anything they say, it isn't above the law. And they have to be informed that of the benefits, but also the drawbacks to participating. And
there are risks.
There are risks. But my chief concern is that the state has no stomach for investigating the state. And a truth commission would be the IRA coming to a truth commission and telling what they did. And then the British government saying, and its forces saying, oh, that's very interesting. And then they'll not be in the room. It's going to be partisan. That's the way it has been. The state has so much to cover up. And in fact, from my position as a Republican, the state was responsible for provoking the crisis and often for prolonging the crisis. And also, when Barney mentioned judges there, and the judges here, in my opinion, throughout the 70s and the 80s, were biased and were just part of the state apparatus for putting people away through a conveyor belt. We know that. 80% of the people who went to the H blocks were convicted on self-incriminating statements. Unsupported by any, without any corroboration.
We're nearly out of time. Final word, Nuala.
I just want to say something. We're having a controversy at the moment about what happened in the hunger strikes. Mm-hmm. We have all the documentation from the state. We have everything released. And we cannot get a single identification of what happened. And nobody is going to be charged with anything in respect of the hunger strikes. I do not believe that historical truth-telling exercises will produce anything which will assist the processes of justice and the establishment of the rule of law in this country.
Is that a rare moment of unanimity?
I think we have a contested history.
It looks like it.
I think we have a contested history. I don't think we're going to achieve absolute truth or anything like it. But I think until we have an amnesty or something else that is dressed up as an amnesty, then there is no safe storytelling process and no possibility of the type of confidentiality that was supposedly agreed in the Boston College project.
The voice of the Jean McConville's children and those people like them is not heard at the present time. It must be heard.
I think it's got to be the final word. Okay, well, I think, you know, history is continuation of the war by other means in many respects.
My thanks to Baroness Nuala O'Loan, Brian Rowan, Danny Morrison and William Plum Smith, who chose to leave the discussion a little bit earlier. The new year brought with it the old reliables, debt, bad weather, and the list of those awarded honours by the Queen. The recipients range from the man who forced the UK to decriminalise homosexuality in Northern Ireland to a breastfeeding coordinator. But what does it mean to be a member of an Order of the British Empire? Is that something to be proud of, or would a Wikipedia read of history suggest it might be a matter of shame? Alan McFarlane served Queen and country in the army. He's still waiting for a gong. But Ola Meredith, however, is unlikely to receive one after her recent comments in the Belfast Telegraph. What have you been saying in the Belfast Telegraph?
Well, just that I'm not very happy with the honours system in general. I think it's class-bound. I think it's full of cronyism. I think the whole thing is veiled in secrecy, so we don't know exactly how it's decided who gets honours and who doesn't. But
there's an honours committee and you can make nominations.
Oh, yes, and of course there's all this talk about extraordinary people from all walks of life who've made a difference to their community.
Many but have. Then,
yeah, that's true, and you always have a certain proportion of people, local heroes, community volunteers who've been working away for years without any recognition, and if they decide they want to take an honour, fair enough, I wouldn't, but that's their personal decision. What I don't like is when you get all these kind of Whitehall bigwigs, there's, you know, high ranking civil servants who seem to automatically get some kind of honour. That happened last year with the head of the civil service in Northern Ireland. He got some incredibly complicated sounding thing. What was it? The Knight Commander of the Civil Division of the Most Honourable Order of the Bath.
KCB,
correct. Yep. Yeah. But again, the thing that really bugs me are people like, again, this year, we've had a disgraced property tycoon getting a CBE. We've had a guy called Paul Ruddock. He got a knighthood. He was a Tory donor who made millions from the credit crunch.
So he got that for charity work, didn't he?
He did. But the fact remains that, you know, the rich and powerful often know each other and they nominate each other, and that's why I don't like the system. Of course, leaving aside the whole inheritance of empire, that's something else again.
So you've got problems with empire, Alan. She's got problems with empire, cronyism, obsequiousness and a class culture. That's what the honour system seems to prop up for Fionnuala. Do you agree?
Yeah, but you have to understand where all this come from. I mean, for thousands of years, tribal chieftains after conflicts have doled out the spoils of war, whether it's food or loot or pillage or whatever. For hundreds of years, it's been quite an order. For example, Nelson's time, if you captured a ship, the contents of that ship were handed them out amongst your crew. So there's nothing unusual in tribal chieftains, or in our case, the monarchy, handing out rewards for loyalty and good work. It's evolved over time. We have a long tradition in Britain for this sort of awarding. We've built up, I think the Normans introduced knighthoods when they came in. Over the years, we have introduced all sorts of other orders of chivalry. And it's a way of saying thank you to people who have given valiant service.
I see David Hockney got an Order of Merit. He already has a Companion of Honour Award, a CH after his name. But it appears that he turned down a knighthood in 1990 because he doesn't agree with titled honours. There are people who don't agree with titled honours because they think that props up the class system.
Yes. And I mean, people have an argument, and for another thing, made it about the business of why are we calling it the British Empire. We tried, I think, in 06, when they reviewed this, to turn it into the Order of British Excellence. Now, I mean, we love tradition. Our country is built on tradition. Yeah. We're the best in the world at ceremony.
But we're not an empire anymore.
No, but everybody knows that. No one's in any doubt.
But still, that's the trouble when you start invoking empire. I mean, you're still in some way signing up to that inheritance.
Are you really? I mean, if you go to the
extent,
Empire Club, are you signing up to the British
Empire?
The same is it not
thing.
The same?
I don't think
I mean, it's a vacant metaphor, isn't it? But it hints at something
I
about
think
the
if
past.
You apply something particularly to yourself, if you accept that title, you are in some way commemorating what empire did. And empire, of course, I mean,
there were noble
aspirations there. Democracy, good governance, free speech. I mean,
Expansion, money, oil.
Exactly,
gold.
That's what I'm just coming to. As George Orwell said, empire was a despotism with theft as its final object. And we've got to remember that there is that hugely negative exploitative
side.
So
you would never take an honour with the word empire in it?
No, because
would you take
I
an honour without the word empire
for?
In it?
Probably not. I'm uncomfortable.
So you're opposed
to
honours, whatever they're called.
I'm uncomfortable with the whole thing. I know what you're saying, Alan, about ceremony and tradition and heritage and all that, but I'm just not comfortable with that. And the system itself is just so flawed. It's so full, as I say, it's just so full of cronyism.
Well, it's better now than it used to be. It used to be basically you had three levels. You've had politics and you got rewards in politics. You had the military and you got rewards in the military, and you got a degree of rewards for sort of social service, if you like. it became very complex. I mean, Lloyd George was sacked or lost his good name in 1926 because he was selling honours for cash because he was trying to build a party. We had a row over Tony Blair.
He got investigated by the police.
Absolutely. And for years, people have abused these things. You could argue now whether they did or didn't and why they, etc., is sometimes open to question. But the system was changed, I think, in 2006, where you allowed then people, anybody in society, to recommend
this
someone else.
This is John Major's change.
John Major's
change.
The people
think that's awards, window really. Dressing. Yes. I really do. I don't think the system has fundamentally changed. I think in some ways it's getting worse. Look at the reintroduction of the British Empire Medal, or BEM. It was scrapped in 1993 by John Major on the grounds that it was out of date and entrenched class divisions. Now David Cameron wants to bring it back, part of the whole big society thing. He sees it as, you know, rewarding people in the voluntary services. I think it is a very much a token award for sort of, you know, people who are seen as somehow lesser, lower down.
You need some way to reward people. For example,
cleaners don't get knighthoods.
No, but the Irish government, I think, at the moment are desperately trying to find some system for rewarding people who've done good works, valiant service. How do you say thank you to people? Now, there's a problem with all of this in that in some cases these are used to buy off dissidents. If someone disagrees with your point of view, what you do is you square them away with a particular honour. There are all sorts of
perhaps more worrying is perhaps more worrying the dissidence, though, is what it does to establishment people. You can dangle an honour in front of someone's face for a career and keep them in line, and they
and
don't
some
challenge
people
the establishment.
Hold off getting particular honours in hope of a better one.
Yes, but it's become much more difficult now with a new system. It's much harder now.
Michael
it's,
Winner did that.
It's much more.
I think he turned down an
no
OBE and said that
there.
You know, I wouldn't consider anything less than a knighthood. Thank you very much.
And there's a pecking order. I mean, people who get an MBE when they feel they're at a stage in their life when they're senior and should
they
have
should
an
be
OBE
a CBE.
Or CBE.
But then, of course, there's these incredibly populist awards like Rory McIlroy. What did he get, an MBE?
He got an MBE.
That then? You know, I mean...
But Darren got an OBE.
Yeah, so
how
does that...
a bit longer.
Is that why?
Yes,
because
so.
It doesn't, it doesn't make sense to me. It seems arbitrary.
It's the way the system works, and you have, I suppose, it relates to your experience, your contribution, and it's not unusual. Again, it goes back. If you were a pirate captain and doling out the thing, means your sidekicks
this
got
piracy
more.
Image is not a very interesting moral comparison you're making.
No, but
it?
It's the way tribal chieftains have rewarded their subjects and their friends and colleagues for good work and loyalty or bravery in battle since time immemorial.
But we're not at that stage now. We're not at that stage of civilization.
No, but,
surely we've
sorry,
moved
politics,
on from tribal
politics
chieftains.
To parody Clausewitz, is war by other means. You know, what you're in here, you know, are in politics particularly, people are rewarded for long service and they're rewarded for support. And you can see that all the way through. If you are a donor and give £1 million to someone, and there was a whole row, as you know, back with Tony Blair, where I think they'd worked out between 97 and 06, all of those who received, or an enormous number anyway, of those who received peerages and knighthoods had actually contributed £1 million to the Labour Party. Now, and that's why it was reformed again.
To take out the worst excesses, but I don't think the system has been fundamentally reformed. I think it's still loaded with class prejudice.
What's the honour you would take, Fionnuala?
I wouldn't take any of those honours.
Nobel just Prize, maybe?
Oh, that kind of honour. Oh, well, if anybody was offering, you know.
You'd be happy with that. What do you think's the top one, Alan? What's the one that the juiciest of them all, the juiciest gong in your piracy box?
Well, I suppose. Well, it depends what you've been doing. I mean, for example, if you are going on and are see yourselves a further contribution than a peerage at the moment, where they're talking about elected peers, etc. If you've come to the end of your time, a knighthood where your wife can be called lady or whatever might be quite attractive. People have different people have different ideas of what their status is. Some people don't like them at all, and you can quite understand that.
Thank you very much to both of you. Yeah, you get the order of Sunday sequence, both of you, for your appearance today, Fionnuala Meredith and Alan McFarland.
You've been listening to Everyday Ethics from the BBC with me, William Crawley. For more information, go to our website, bbc.co.uk/podcasts.